Hi, good morning. My name is Talia Zisak, and today's topic is postmodern Jewish history. I'll be speaking about rabbinic alumni of both ICJA, my alma mater, class of 2000, and Hebrew Theological College. Now, when I took speech class at Stern College, I learned that it's important when you're speaking about any topic to first establish credibility, which is an important step, meaning that you explain to your audience what makes you qualified to talk about this topic. Now, this makes me very nervous because 2 weeks ago, when I agreed to give this shiur, I felt really unqualified to speak about this topic. I'll be speaking about three people who I really knew very little about at the time. I've been working very hard for the last 2 weeks. but I'll tell you what I do think makes me qualified to speak about this topic is that I am a graduate of Ida Crown Jewish Academy. I'm very proud of my roots. And Reb Nosson Tzvi Finkel, one of the people we'll be focusing on today, is also an alum of ICJA. And my husband works for HTC and graduated their high school and is a musmach of their smicha program and graduated from their college. So we have a lot of Chicago roots, in our education and our family. So I'm very excited to talk about these people who are, some of the most famous of the graduates of Ida Crown Jewish Academy and Hebrew Theological College. So without further ado, let's look at the first page. The first person I'm going to speak about is Rabbi Beryl Wein. Rabbi Wein, just to give you a few notes about his life, he was born in 1934. You could do the math. He received smicha from HTC in 1956 and a doctorate in 1959. And I just put here a couple of words that I think sum up his life's work. He's a historian, an author, and a lecturer who brings Jewish history into Jewish homes. So this is a preface that I typed out from his book, Triumph of Survival, The Story of the Jews in the Modern Era. He has these four enormous volumes of Jewish history that he has written, and they've really become part of the parlance. They've taken Jewish history from, the scholarly realm into Jewish living rooms, and really made them, really made Jewish history popular. And it's both his lectures that are recorded and his writings that have made Jewish history really for the masses, accessible to the masses. So I'm going to ask for a volunteer to start reading. We're very fortunate that due to the nature of our topic, all the sources are in English. So I think that levels the playing field. Does anyone want to start out reading? Okay, we have a lot of volunteers. Yes, please go ahead.
It has truly been noted that history is too important to be left to the historians. This is certainly true in the case of Jewish history. Jewish history as a discipline and Jewish history books in general did not come into vogue until the late 19th century. Jewish historiography, therefore, has been almost exclusively the product of secular Jews who held a strong bias against rabbinical Torah Judaism. Thus, the irony of most Jewish history texts is that they have been written with condescension, if not hostility, for the basic beliefs and true heroes of Jewry over the centuries. It would not be an exaggeration to say that many books on Jewish history by non-Jews have been much more insightful, sensitive, and sympathetic to their subject matter than those written by objective-minded secular Jews. Thus, almost by default, a great deal of current Jewish history books, articles, and texts are not truly Jewish and are
I'm sorry, that was a typo. Are not truly Jewish.
Okay. Are not truly Jewish and are barely accurate Jewish history.
Okay, great. Does someone want to give her a break and pick up where she left off? Yes, please.
I am not a historian, nor the son of a historian. I have, however, spent years reading, researching, writing, and lecturing about the Jewish people and their place in the world. All authors write from a personal bias. Mine is that I am an Orthodox Jew who believes in the divinity of Jewish tradition and in the uniqueness of the people of Israel. There exists within the Jewish people a collective memory of its history. This collective memory operates independently of research materials, books, and other acceptable historical evidence. One benefit of being an Orthodox Jew is having access to this memory bank of events, insights, worldviews, and life-giving legends. My education in the yeshiva, my good fortune in knowing and conversing with some of the last great Eastern European rabbis, and my family tradition and its members have combined to allow me a glimpse of this collective memory treasure of Israel.
Okay, excellent. I just wanted to mention that when I did a search for Rabbi Beryl Wein online, I found a remarkable video. It's up on YouTube. You can look at it if you're interested. It's a speech that he gave regarding Holocaust denial. And he talked about the kind of the roots of Holocaust denial. How can such a thing be possible that these events that transpired, you know, merely 60 years ago, that there are still eyewitnesses to attest to, could be denied by people now? And he says that, unfortunately, Holocaust denial is not just a phenomenon that exists among non-Jews who are anti-Semitic. It's even seeping into the Jewish world. And he gave, by way of analogy, a story about, evidently there was a chumash published by a very liberal-leaning publication. And in the back of that chumash, there were publications from different rabbis and scholars. One of the rabbis that was published in the back of that chumash had given a sermon on Pesach about how all the events that the chumash records about Pesach, about the exodus from Egypt, receiving the Torah, you know, the splitting of the Red Sea, none of those things actually happened because there's no historical evidence to support it. You know, so Rabbi Beryl Wein, who, if you've ever read his works or heard his lectures, he, you know, he doesn't refrain from putting in his opinions. He said, you know, so if I were in that shul, I would have, you know, gone on a coffee break, gone to the ball game. You know, like, what's the point of all this? If it, you know, what's the point of celebrating Pesach if none of this happened? But he says that the travesty of this person who calls himself a rabbi saying that none of these stories of the Jewish people actually happened is as follows. He said, every person has a story, and every nation has a story. And to deprive a people of their stories is, to a certain extent, even worse than depriving a people of the basic tenets of their faith. Because the stories are what make up a people. The stories are what make a people who they are. So if a rabbi could deny the exodus from Egypt, then it's not such a far cry to say that a person who is Jewish could even deny something like the Holocaust. And I think that video really speaks to what Rabbi Beryl Wein is trying to do in his professional life. You know, that his life's work is really to record the stories of the Jewish people, because it's the stories that make up the Jewish people. So this collective experience, I'm going to keep reading here from the top of the page, has shaped my view of events, past and present, and my judgments regarding people, movements, and directions among the Jewish people. Perhaps more than anything else, it has been my guide to the choice of facts, occurrences, and people I have included in my narrative. It is why I consider this book to be a Jewish history book. Nevertheless, I've quoted extensively from non-Jewish sources as well as non-Orthodox Jews, because I believe that for a history to be fair and accurate, its author must take into account what others have to say and their view of events. It is also illuminating to find that many non-traditional Jews are aware of the verities of Torah and traditional Jewish life and how they affect the way, I'm sorry, that should say Jewish history unfolds and should be understood, thus confirming much of the traditional outlook on Jewish events. Finally, the ancient Jewish doctrine of accepting truth from whoever says it must be honored in a book like this. That is the ancient Jewish doctrine of accepting the truth from whoever says it. That was made famous by the Rambam. The Rambam says, you know, the reason that I'll quote from people like Aristotle is because you have to accept the truth from whoever says it. So, you know, none less than the Rambam said, you know, I won't just quote from Jewish sources. Superficially, at least, the history of the Jewish people is an unrelieved litany of disaster, persecution, and horror. Perhaps it is precisely this that lends a peculiar fascination to the story of the Jewish people. Once the raw facts are digested, three essential questions remain to plague the student of Jewish history. One, why did such a fate befall Jewry? Two, how has the Jewish people persevered and survived against such brutal forces? And three, what is the ultimate meaning of its struggle for survival? To me, the answer to these questions can be found only in the realm of the supernatural. These are matters of theology and soul, and not merely of politics and human conditions. There are no laws of natural history nor any rules of civilized development that can adequately answer the paradox of Jewish persecution and survival. Behold, and he's quoting from Chumash here, it is a people that shall dwell apart and not be reckoned among the nations. So he's really lending credence to his whole approach in recording and presenting Jewish history, that this is a uniquely Jewish book of Jewish history, not just because he himself is an Orthodox Jew, but because his whole perspective is shaped by the fact that he doesn't see the Jewish people as being just another people. The more I read and study Jewish history, the clearer it becomes that there is an author and planner, capital A, capital P, who guides Israel to its destiny. It is my prayer that this book will help its readers share this vision. Now I'm going to pose a question to all of you. My question is, can we try to sum up what drives Rabbi Beryl Wein? You know, what are his goals in, you know, in presenting Jewish history? It's not a trick question. Some of them we've already mentioned explicitly. Yes, Bonnie.
Well, I think one goal is clearly to, I really like what he said about presenting Jewish history from a Jewish observant standpoint as opposed to trying to be, Jews always go out of their way to be objective.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that we shouldn't sound too Jewish, you know.
Yeah.
And I think he acknowledges that we are telling a history of our people, and it is essential to tell it from our viewpoint, infused with the spirituality, because without that dimension, it is not a true history.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, to piggyback on what you're saying, I think it's very humble of Rabbi Wein to say all authors write from a personal bias, and here's mine. Mm-hmm. You know, and he's not purporting to be objective, because it human beings are subjective. So everyone has a bias. Mine is I'm an Orthodox Jew. Anything else? I think Bonnie really summed it up. But does anyone want to add?
Can I interject something?
Sure.
This paragraph where he talks about the history of the Jewish people superficially,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure you're familiar with some of Rabbi Sachs's commentaries, and I was particularly struck by that because some of his essays with regard to Pesach is that how he counters that we could look at this from a point of despair, but in fact it's a point of hope, because as we move from era to era, generation to generation, we still hope despite all this.
Yes.
That there is a future.
Yes, and I just want to mention that lecture about Holocaust denial that I saw online by Rabbi Wein, he talks about how one of the I guess forces behind Holocaust denial is the fact that there is nothing as unbelievable and hard to deal with as the Holocaust. You know, so when you look at Holocaust denial and say, how could someone deny the Holocaust? Well, look at the Holocaust. How could someone believe in the Holocaust? To believe that something like that happened is mind-boggling, you know? And so I think what you're saying, Bonnie, really plays into that, that we have to look at it from a standpoint of there's something beyond us that we don't understand. You know, there's, as he says, an author and a planner, you know, that is driving these events. He is unfathomable. You know, and without that piece, it is impossible to understand the simple fact that the Holocaust happened. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Does anyone want to add anything before we move on to our next famous rabbi? Yes?
I
I read a book about anti-Semitism a while ago. I forgot who wrote it. It was, When I don't think, basically, if people are, I don't think it's that it's too horrible to believe, because, you know, it's like, you know, 30 years from now, hopefully, you know, people say, well, there weren't these genocides in Africa, and I think the bottom line is that it's because they're not believing the Jewish people. Because I think if there's any other group, and it wasn't that long ago, the Shoah, and Holocaust denial did not just start this year either. It's been going for a while.
Right, so it's true.
For people to come up from Mexico and tell what happened in their villages. You know, 20 years from now, people saying it didn't happen. I don't think it's because people don't believe. Maybe some. But the people who are saying it have to know because they're researching it.
Right.
And they're finding ways to show that it wasn't true.
I hear you.
So,
I mean, I chose to include, you know, something written. So I hope I'm not misrepresenting the video, and I think it's could die to look at it since, you know, I hope I'm not misrepresenting it, but, you know, I'm not really sure what to say in response I may be oversimplifying what he said in the video.
I'm not sure why that bothers me when you say it, but it might be because that's kind of seeping in to Jewish thought also.
Yeah.
Give credence to that point of view.
To the denying
point
of view.
Just because it's so horrible, that's why people don't believe it. And I think some, but I don't think believers of that movement don't
believe it. Right. I hear you. Yeah, I see a bunch of hands up. Yeah.
I would also agree with what she says. I think it's just like saying, you know, if you're anti-Zionist, doesn't mean you're anti-Jewish. This is definitely anti-Jewish.
Yeah.
Anti-Semitic wave. And if you look at the media today, it's becoming worse and worse, so biased against Judaism, against Israel. And I teach Hebrew school. I've been teaching for years and years. And I teach in Northbrook, which is a very, very liberal, very stuff, and it's frightening. These kids, middle school kids, they find all kinds of ways to justify the Arabs, the Palestinians, Hamas. It's they want to be so liberal. And I used to be like that. You know, but when you look at what's going on now, I mean, this is just another form of anti-Semitism.
Yeah, that also is one of the major themes that he focuses on in his Holocaust denial, you know, lecture. He talks about, you know, just how pervasive it is, this attitude of anti-Semitism, and it may be cloaked in different terminology, but it's all that old anti-Semitism. You know, maybe cloaked in the terminology of anti-Zionism, and, you know, we side with the Palestinians because they're the underdog, et cetera, et cetera. But it's really just a new, you know, a new set of clothes for the same old problem. Yes?
Just to continue on that thought, I agree with you completely.
Thank you.
But what you had mentioned, Talia, about your story is you. When you deny somebody's story, you deny their personhood, or in the case of the Jews, their peoplehood. Mm-hmm. And it's a way of delegitimizing the Jewish people to take away that the Holocaust is so much a part of our understanding of the world and our, you know, our peopleness, that you take that away, and then that is belittled and delegitimized.
Can I just say one thing?
Could we go on to the next person?
Yeah.
I think this is a topic we could talk for hours about.
Yeah, I agree. Is it quick?
Okay. I just wanted to say that I was teaching Jewish history myself, and when I said the Holocaust, I had a group of Jewish kids, the Holocaust was the worst thing ever to happen to any people. I had so many kids disagreeing with me. It was very scary.
Mm-hmm.
That it was not. That's all I want to say.
Yeah. I really think that if you have time tonight or whatever, look it up, you know, because it's really a fascinating lecture. I think even the caption on the the caption of you know, of the uploader on YouTube was Rabbi Berlwein on Holocaust denial, most ingenious, you know, so they're putting in a little plug for his lecture. But I really thought it was food for thought in many ways. Okay, so we're going to move to Rabbi Dr. Abraham J. Tursky. In fact, a lot of the members of the Tursky dynasty studied at HTC. And one thing I want to mention, when I originally was planning this year, I was planning on only speaking about alumni of ICJA, because I feel that to whatever extent I'm, you know, qualified to talk about this topic as a graduate of ICJA, you know, I wanted to keep it narrowed to that. However, it's somewhat confusing when you go back in history because ICJA and HTC used to be one institution. So you'll see, you know, someone famous like Rabbi Tursky, Rabbi Wein, Rabbi Nassim Tzvi Finkel, Alav HaShalom, both institutions will claim that he was a graduate of their school. Because, I mean, why not, right? But they really were, you know, kind of separate, but within one building, under one roof, under, you know, one name. So, not one name, I should say, whatever, but they separated at some point to become distinct entities, whereas back then, they were not. So Rabbi Dr. Abraham J. Tursky is, I would say, maybe the most famous Tursky who studied at HTC. He attended the Beis Medrash in college in 1951, and he's a rabbi and a psychiatrist. Oh my gosh, that's a huge typo. He's really a psychiatrist, although he does practice therapy, and he has an addiction rehab center in Pittsburgh, I believe. And this is an article that I really feel he's talking about a specific subject, a specific issue, but I thought that it really gives a very good snapshot into his worldview and his way of approaching things. It's called Histapkus versus Consumerism and Entitlement. Does anyone want to give a stab at what how you would translate Histapkus or Histapkut? So I would say Histapkut means being satisfied with little. Being satisfied with what you have. Okay, so he starts off by quoting two consecutive verses in the book of Devarim. He afflicted you and let you hunger, and he fed you the manna, lest you eat and be satisfied and build good houses and settle. My 40 years of working in addiction have proven the truth of the statement of Ramchal in Mesilas Yesharim, that we must be most cautious that our wants do not become needs. This is the theme of Precious. The core of addiction, whether it be to drugs, alcohol, gambling, food, or whatever else, is that a desire for something, which a person could at one time decide whether or not to gratify, can become so intense a need that a person may do anything and everything to gratify it. The cocaine or heroin addict will do whatever is necessary to get the drug, cheat, steal, and yes, one may even kill. Some Holocaust survivors came to Israel with only the clothes they were wearing. Our shul gathered clothes, and we sent many bundles of them to Israel. We received a thank you letter from one recipient, and it was on her personalized stationery. I asked my father how a person who is so destitute could afford personalized stationery, and he explained that before the war, she was very wealthy. Right, but she didn't still have her personalized stationery from pre-war. To her, personalized stationery had become a necessity, not a luxury. So even if she didn't have clothes to wear, she needed that personalized stationery. That's what has happened to many people in today's society. There are two major influences that affect us, consumerism and entitlement. Consumerism is an industry wherein the media is used to make us believe that there are certain things that we must have. A prime example of this are children who so carry on that they must have a particular doll or toy that was advertised, that in order to keep their sanity, the parents get it for them. Never mind that in a few days, the doll or toy may end up on the heap of toys in the closet. While we may not be able to fault the juvenile mind, The fact is that many adults are taken in by consumerism and are convinced that some things are vital for their existence. The Stipler Gaon once had the students come in for the shiur, which he delivered while lying in bed. He was not sick, but he only had one pair of pants, which were at the tailor. The second principle that is operative today is entitlement. Many people believe that they are entitled to what others have, even if they have not done anything to earn it. When I was a child, we had no air conditioning, microwaves, washer dryers, television, cell phones, and many other gadgets that are in common use today. I think you really see here how he's a product of his times, and he uses his age and his upbringing and his experiences to inform his perspective on life. You know, you can tell from listening to this about how old he is. You know, he's in his 80s. When I was a child, and as much as we survived, it is obvious that these are not necessities of life. However, they've become necessities. If people earn enough to afford these luxuries, they may certainly have them. However, there are able-bodied people who are recipients of charity who believe that they are entitled to these, right? Has it ever happened to you? This has happened to me. You give some food to someone who's begging for money, and they throw it back in your face. Like, I wanted the money so I could buy cigarettes, because I need cigarettes, you know, or whatever it is that they need. I don't like that restaurant, you know. I don't like, beggars can't be choosers, but sometimes they think they can be, because wants become needs. And how can you deprive me of my needs? To deny them these things is considered as heartless as if they were denied food, clothing, or shelter. The Stipler Gaon writes that in his childhood, candy was virtually unheard of. A fresh apple was a treat, and the new suit for Pesach was really a hand-me-down that had been altered, and the child was thrilled to get it. Today's children feel that they are entitled to everything, and if they do not get what they are entitled to, they are unhappy and angry. This attitude persists into adult life, and the Stipler Gaon believed it is the leading cause of much unhappiness. There are many Jewish families that live below the poverty line and are in need of food and rent money, and it is the greatest mitzvah to help them. But many people have become accustomed to a lifestyle of much more than their basic needs, and their children feel that they are entitled to similar standards. Even people supported by public funds may believe that this is their due. There are many students who study Torah with great dedication and true Mesiras Nefesh. What does Mesiras Nefesh mean? Maybe self-sacrifice. Yeah. Did I sum it up? I'm sorry. I jumped too quickly. It is difficult to, self-sacrifice, I think sums it up. Okay. It is difficult to live according to the literal meaning of the Mishnah. This is the way of Torah. Eat bread with salt, drink water in small measures, sleep on the ground, live a life of deprivation, but toil in the Torah. But many students do live a frugal life. The wife of one Kohler younger man was asked, "Don't you have a husband? We never see him at Simchas." She answered, "My husband says that he is not being paid to go to weddings. In other words, we only go to what we get paid for." The conclusion of the above-cited Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says, "If you do this, you will be happy in this world, and it will be good for you in the world to come." Rabbi Simcha Zissel said that if one only observes how others live in greater comfort, one cannot be happy in this world. But if you do this, i.e., if you indeed live a frugal life, you will achieve happiness. From personal contact, I can tell you that the Stipler Gaon was a happy person. His home had the very barest of furnishings, but he was far happier than some people who live in splendor. However, there are some Bachurim who have been affected by the prevailing entitlement and consumerism attitudes. Their expectation of a shidduch is that the father-in-law will provide them with expensive living quarters and furnishings and with a comfortable stipend. This is inconsistent with the statement, "The Torah was given to be studied only by those who ate the man," which is in Tanchuma B'Shalach. Obviously, the Torah was given to all future generations, but the Medrash means that the Torah was given to be studied only by those who live a frugal life, such as surviving with the rations of the man. It is possible that some young women cannot get a shidduch because their fathers are unable to meet... is it possible that some young women cannot get a shidduch because their fathers are unable to meet the boys' demands? If this is so, it is a most serious indictment. Stone was destroyed because of the complaints of one young woman. We must take caution to avoid being influenced by the prevailing attitudes in our environment. The message of consumerism is that without this you cannot be happy. Falling prey to consumerism is dangerously similar to the bottomless pit of drug addiction, where there is never any gratification that endures for more than minutes. Indeed, many youngsters, even youngsters from families who have fallen into the trap of drugs, were looking for the happiness of which consumerism convinced them they had been deprived. Many of the Sifrei Musar emphasize the importance of hystapkos, being satisfied with the bare necessities. This is a counterculture attitude in direct opposition to the consumerism and entitlement attitudes. However, even some of the frum world do not adhere to hystapkos, which is an important principle of living a true Torah life. We would do well to examine our values and see whether they are really consistent with Torah values. So here's my question. I just want to sum up Rabbi Tursky's words. This is, like I said, a snapshot. He is a very prolific writer and speaker, but I thought that this was a good example that really shows the different perspectives and types of sources that he draws on. So here's my question. What would you guess are the different types of sources that he has drawn from for this article? By sources, I don't mean that he looked them up, but they're at his fingertips.
His own experiences.
Yeah, absolutely, his own experiences.
Torah.
Yeah, Torah, absolutely. And within Torah, let's detail more. He is quoted from many different types of Torah sources. He's quoted from Sukkim. He's quoted from Midrashim. He's quoted from Gemaras. He's quoted from Sifrei Musar. He does quote extensively from Sifrei Musar, and I think there's a really direct logical connection specifically between the Sifrei Musar, the works that are centered on self-improvement, and his work in psychology specifically with addiction. He has written books that, where he explains the parallels between the 12 steps and the Sifrei Musar, how the Jewish works on self-improvement really, work hand in hand with that type of approach. Anything else? Mom?
I was just going to say that I heard him speak 10 or so years ago.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to acknowledge that he's really living in both worlds. He's living in a Torah world and he's living in a secular world.
Yeah.
And he has a secular education and he values a secular education also. And with regard to that, when he was talking about some of the Bokrim, he had said at that point that it's fine if a young man wants to sit and learn, but I think it was a 5-year maximum that he put on it for most young men.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, and then they would drop him off. And I thought that was just a very, coming back to this, to be realistic and in this world, if you're not an Ilui, don't expect to sit and learn for years and years and be supported by somebody.
Yeah.
But take the responsibility just to provide for your family and yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. I should mention, by the way, I called somebody mom, but I also have Ima here, so I have two moms. I have my husband's mother and my own mother, and all of you, so I'm very fortunate. Okay, moving on to Rabbi Nassim Tzvi Finkel. I saved him for last because his yahrzeit was this year. Rabbi Nassim Tzvi Finkel passed away in Cheshvan of this year. So there's a specific focus on him, specifically in Chicago because he did grow up here. And I just wanted to mention that Rabbi Chanuch Teller is coming in and speaking about Rabbi Nassim Tzvi Finkel this coming Thursday at Shalitz at a program that just coincidentally was pioneered by my husband. I'm just saying. So last year when Rabbi Teller came in to speak, the crowd, it drew a crowd such as Shalitz has never seen before for their speakers, and I don't have to put in a plug for Rabbi Teller. He's wonderful, and he recently wrote a book about Rabbi Finkel that I just read cover to cover in the last 2 weeks. It's a quick read. It's very captivating, which helped to give me information for this year. So without further ado, Rabbi Nassim Tzvi Finkel grew up in Chicago, and he went to ICJA. He was very proud of the fact that he went to ICJA. He was known for speaking to a group, you know, of American students, you know, whether they be on an NCSY program or, you know, if he had American students in the mirror, he would say, how many of you are from Chicago? Mm-hmm. A certain amount would raise their hand. How many of you go to the academy? You know, and a certain amount would put their hand up. How many of you are on the basketball team? You know, so they would raise their hand, and he said, I'm from Chicago. I went to ICJA. I was on the basketball team. You could be a Rosh Yeshiva, because he was the Rosh Yeshiva of the Mir. And, you know, that message really speaks for itself. You know, he didn't put it under the rug where he came from. And I just want to dwell on this point for a moment, because we've heard of this phenomenon of kids flipping out, right? Froming out, right? Going to Israel and, you know, wanting to forsake everything about their upbringing because now they're too from for that. Mm-hmm. Rabbi Finkel never did that. You know, and I think it just makes his message all that more powerful, because he said, I'm a proud Chicagoan. I'm a proud graduate of the academy. And, you know, and this is where I got to in life. And, you know, and I'm not ashamed to say where I came from, because that informs who I am. You know, and I'm also a flag-waving academy graduate. So I'm not a Rosh Yeshiva. But, you know, but I think each one of us, you know, can be great and should be great, and not despite where we came from, but because of it. I get nervous when people, you know, whatever, I don't know what that meant. How much longer do we have? Okay, like 5 minutes? So, the little quotation I put here is bringing Torah to the masses, because he, the Mir is this sprawling, huge yeshiva. I believe it's the largest in the world, the Mir Yerushalayim. It has a bunch of satellite Batei Midrash, and, you know, it's just huge. So Rabbi Finkel would not turn anyone away from his yeshiva. There are all these stories in Rabbi Teller's book about, you know, just how far he was willing to go to get one more student from no matter where he was. Who would like to read this article by Howard Schultz, the chairman of Starbucks? Ema, you want to do it? Or Bonnie, go ahead. Yeah, please.
Oh, okay. Think about all our experiences every day. How often does anybody honor us as a consumer? Rarely. But when it does happen, the power of the human spirit really does come through. At the end of the day, when business is really good, it's not about building a brand or making money. That's a means to an end. It's about honoring the human spirit, honoring the people who work in the business, and honoring the customer. Okay. When I was in Israel, I went to Mea Shearim, the ultra-Orthodox area within Jerusalem. Along with a group of businessmen I was with, I had the opportunity to have an audience with Rabbi Nussan Svi Finkel, the head of a yeshiva there, Mir Yeshiva. I had never heard of him. I didn't know anything about him. We went into his study and waited 10 to 15 minutes for him. Finally, the doors opened. What we did not know was that Rabbi Finkel was severely afflicted with Parkinson's disease. He sat down at the head of the table, and naturally our inclination was to look away. We didn't want to embarrass him. We were all looking away, and we heard this big bang on the table. Gentlemen, look at me right now. Now his speech affliction was worse than his physical shaking. It was really hard to listen to him and watch him. He said, I have only a few minutes for you because I know you're all busy American businessmen. You know, just a little dig there.
Okay. Do you mind continuing?
No, I don't. Okay. I don't want to. Then he asked, who can tell me what the lesson of the Holocaust is? He called on one guy who didn't know what to do. It was like being called on in the fifth grade without the answer. And the guy says something benign like, well, we will never, ever forget. And the rabbi completely dismisses him. I felt terrible for the guy until I realized the rabbi was getting ready to call on someone else. All of us were sort of under the table looking away, you know, please not me. He did not call me. I was sweating. He called on another guy who had such a fantastic answer. We will never, ever again be a victim or bystander. The rabbi said, you guys just don't get it. Okay, gentlemen. Let me tell you the essence of the human spirit. As you know, during the Holocaust, the people were transported in the worst possible inhumane way by rail car. They thought they were going to a work camp. We all know they were going to a death camp. For after hours and hours in this inhumane corral with no light, no bathroom, cold, they arrived at camps. The doors were swung wide open. They were blinded by the light. Men were separated from women, mothers from daughters, fathers from sons. They went off to the bunkers to sleep. As they went into the area to sleep, only one person was given a blanket for every six. The person who received the blanket when he went to bed had to decide, am I going to push the blanket to the five other people who did not get one, or am I going to pull it toward myself to stay warm? And Rabbi Finkel says, it was during this defining moment that we learned the power of the human spirit because we pushed the blanket to five others. And with that, he stood up and said, take your blanket, take it to America, and push it to five other people.
Okay. So, I didn't mean to leave us on such a tearjerker kind of note, but I think there are several things I want to bring out from here. One is that Rabbi Finkel did suffer for decades with Parkinson's disease. If you want to see him on video, I think it's powerful just to see how much he suffered physically, how much he struggled. And yet, despite it, he acted as if it was nothing. It was no obstacle at all. One very powerful clip I saw online was Rabbi Finkel speaking about challenges. And you see, it's challenging for him to get up, and it's challenging for him to sit in the chair, and it's challenging for him to speak, and it's challenging for the listeners to understand what he's saying. And he starts with a question that we know that Avraham, the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos tells us that Avraham Avinu had 10 tests, and he passed all of them. So the first test that the Chumash mentions is Lech Lecha Me'artzecha. Hashem commands Avraham to leave his birthplace and, you know, drop everything and go to Eretz Yisrael, Eretz Canaan. That's the first test that's mentioned. Thank you. But the Medrash says that he had another very significant test before that happened, that when he was a youngster, there was the test of Kivshan Ha'esh, that he was tested to prove his commitment to God by walking through a fiery furnace to show his faith. And we know that he walked through the fiery furnace and he came out alive because he truly believed in God. And that's what he was proving to all his, you know, pagan neighbors. Okay, so the question that Rabbi Finkel poses is, why is that relegated to the Medrash? Why doesn't the Torah consider that important enough to mention in the Torah proper? And his answer is because that was a physical test. The physical test was whether Avram would, you know, would endure the flames of the fiery furnace, whether he would, you know, show his faith in Hashem by withstanding the physical hardship of the furnace. And compared to a physical test, physical tests when compared to spiritual tests are nothing. When you look at spiritual tests in the face of a physical test, the physical tests are, what's the word I'm looking for? Insignificant compared to a spiritual test. And that, I think, really sums up Rabbi Finkel's whole attitude toward his Parkinson's disease. He acted like it was nothing. It was insignificant. The only tests that really were significant, that really mattered, were the spiritual tests. How many students can I get learning Torah? How many Chidushe Torah can I write? Those were the things that really mattered to him, and in the face of that, the physical tests were nothing. But you can see that from our perspective, they really were something. And it's very inspiring to see what he was able to conquer in order to accomplish everything that he accomplished. So again, I just want to reiterate that I think if you go home with one thing today, it's that all of us can be great. These are three great men, each in their own right, each in a different way. And all of us can be great, not despite where we're coming from, but because of where we're coming from, because we're from Chicago, and, you know, wherever it is that we grew up, wherever it is that we went to school, we should be proud of that, and that will make us the great people that we can become. Thank you very much for coming. You're welcome.